You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Julie Burstein. I'm in for Leonard Lopate on this beautiful Thursday afternoon, which is lovely to have some sunny weather. Suggestions that United States soldiers in Iraq or Afghanistan might be facing shortages of body armor or driving poorly protected vehicles have caused widespread outrage in recent years. But there's much less discussion about whether our soldiers have been adequately prepared emotionally and morally for their work and its consequences. As soldiers move from civilian to military life and back again, they often struggle with an inner war of ethics and morality that continues long after they've returned from battle. Author and philosopher and psychoanalyst Nancy Sherman explores how soldiers deal with this struggle in her new book, The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. I'm very pleased to welcome Nancy Sherman to the show today.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Now, Nancy, you trained first as a philosopher, and you quote a lot of philosophers in this book, especially the Greeks. Can you tell us about Aristotle and the Stoics and their different approaches to war?
Sure. I am a philosopher first and foremost, but it's still light on the philosophy.
It's really stories of soldiers, but the philosophy underpins it and gives us a sense
right.
of what they're going through.
I listened as a philosopher and and someone trained in psychoanalysis. I don't see patients. And the philosophy that's my true love is Greek philosophy and the ancients. And in particular, Aristotle, who is the philosopher of common sense. And he, like Plato, but also the Stoics, were steeped in war culture. They lived it. They were often involved in wars, etc. And the Stoics who follow Aristotle, so we're talking about 2nd century before the Common Era to 2nd century after, really are suck it up.
Well, we say, just be Stoic.
Yeah. We don't say just be Platonic or just be Aristotelian.
Although that would be kind of nice, actually, if we just
say
be Platonic.
Stoic. So, right. Their philosophy stuck. It's in the vernacular. We know what it means. And it's the military mantra. I taught at the Naval Academy, and it's the ethos, suck it up. And they... the midshipmen and the officers of current wars and of the Vietnam era all resonated. It's in their blood, and it means, despite deprivation, despite hardship, loss, grief, all the emotions, you battle on, you soldier on,
and that is a kind of a way of dealing with things that's respected and assumed that if you're a good soldier, you just hold those things in.
That's right. You wear Stoic armor, so to speak. The hard point that we see and we know is that soldiers are coming back and forth. I call it border passing. They're soldiers in the field, and they're coming home for very short dwell times, home time, and then they're going back again. I heard of someone who was in the sixth redeployment.
The sixth
redeployment. We hear third and fourth, but this is a lot. And they often don't really want to spend that much time at home because it's too hard to shed the skin and then to go out again and toughen it up. So there's the Stoic armor is a blessing of sorts when you're out there. And a previous book was called Stoic Warriors, about the ancient and contemporary connotations. But they wanna not be numb when they come home. They so desperately want to feel, touch, smell, hold their children, and it's hard. It's really hard. And when there's quick back and forth, you can't really take the armor off because you might be redeployed. Even if you're in a hospital, you might be remobilized.
You write about one soldier who had a kind of had to move between those two passages so quickly because he was with a unit in Iraq and all of a sudden was called up to Annapolis and within hours was on a commercial jetliner sitting next to civilians. How do soldiers negotiate that kind of move so quickly from battle to, you know, being asked if they want peanuts?
That's right. In his case, he was telling me this story. It was a Major Michael Mooney. And in fact, I sent him this book as I did all the interviewees, about 30 of them. And he said, "Ma'am, it's in my kit already. I'm heading to Afghanistan." And he's now a lieutenant colonel. He in his case, he had seen three horrific events. He was in Nazaria. They were, his Marine unit was cleaning up a horrible event of the convoy that Jessica Lynch was in, ambushed in. And then his own convoy got hit. And then again, they went back a few months later. So he had three really traumatic events with seeing, still being able to smell the charred, the burning when they went back for the third time. And no sooner did he get there, he gets called up to go back to Annapolis to teach at the, be head of a company at the Naval Academy. And you could hear him as he's talking, and I'm listening, that the jolt and the slight surreal feeling of being in a British Airways, he says it was a British Airways flight, headed to Kuwait, then Frankfurt, and then National. He says, excuse me, ma'am, National Reagan National. And he said, those porcelain toilets, because I hadn't seen a porcelain toilet for 4 months. I hadn't taken a shower for 4 months. And he was about to meet his wife-to-be. And I hadn't seen her in so long. And he's back in Annapolis, and all he can think about are his brothers and sisters at war. And he says, I keep telling my new wife that after these years that we've been here, we're enjoying the beauty of Annapolis and the air conditioning. I keep telling her, I've got to go back to my brothers and sisters in arms. So, and he's at a base, but it's peacetime at his base. And what I write about are these moral feelings, the guilt we don't think about that a soldier, he's not so much as he's a survivor, but he also feels the solidarity. The downside of the solidarity is that you're guilty that you're not with them.
Well, you said it when you were talking about the Stoics, the kinds of feelings that Stoicism allows you to kind of wall off, and guilt is one, shame is another, anger is another. Guilt took so many different forms for the soldiers you quote in the book.
Yes, you know, I think guilt is the elephant in the room. When I was talking to soldiers in virtually all my interviews, they would talk about things that looked and felt like guilt, though they might not articulate that word. When we think about the care of veterans and for returning soldiers who are about to redeploy, we think often about post-traumatic stress disorder. It's a stigmatizing term because of the disorder word.
Yeah, you're right that an amputation is not a disorder.
That's right.
And it's a trauma. And
that's right.
That this psychological trauma is also just that.
That's right. And Jonathan Shea, another person that works in this area, has mentioned this as well. And my, soldiers might talk about hypervigilance or flashbacks and numbing. But what they didn't put words on, because it's not a clinical presentation, is how they felt morally. So the guilt that was Janice faced really took many shapes and forms, as you say, was sometimes what I call accident guilt. You know, one so moving story, this young officer is in charge of a Bradley fighting vehicle and a unit. And the current from the battery misfires. Someone turns on the ignition and it goes right to the turret, to the gun in the turret, ending up blowing off his private's face. Well, he's exonerated, not culpable, no fault. Nothing wrong.
An accident.
It was a real flukish accident. The Marine battery was used. Now we'll only use Army batteries as replacements. But voltage was same, amperage different. That's how minor. But in his case, what he felt, despite the fact that he did nothing wrong, was what we may say, oh, it's just subjective guilt. Get rid of it. Go to a good therapist. Tell a different story about what really happened. A cognitive behavioral therapy, you might say, and it'll be finished. No, for him, it persisted and persisted. But I want to say it was a testament to his humanity. It was what a good commander feels if you lose your privates. And he had to make moral repair, and it was in a very awkward way.
Well, you write about how this soldier's mother felt driven, the man who had died, to continue sending care packages and letters as if the other men in the unit were substitute for her son, and that this leader said, I had to respond to her because that was part of the way that I could make this
make himself whole,
yes,
and be allowed back into the moral community after this perceived wrong. So there is this accident guilt. You know, we read about it in Greek tragedies all the time, but this is everyday soldiers go through this sort of thing, friendly fire incidents. A second kind is a version of survivor guilt, but luck guilt. I'm here, you're not. We were standing next to each other. You were blown up. I wasn't.
You even write about, and this was more towards World War II, the guilt of triumph, that even becoming the victor can lead to a sense of guilt.
That's right. One of my friends came across a trove of her dad's letters, and he couldn't speak about the exuberance of the triumph against the Germans. He was a Canadian Jew, because it was unspeakable to exalt when someone else was dying. And even when they needed food to steal a chicken, he said, "We didn't really steal a chicken from the Germans. It flew into our truck."
You know, the stories about war and about conflict. I just came from my Seders, where you read about the Egyptians being drowned in the Red Sea, and yet you're not supposed to rejoice. And it's so the complicated moral stance, even when your enemies are vanquished, is tough for many.
Yes,
people.
You know, you're out there as a foot soldier or as a helicopter, drones, pilots are a whole other story, a different complex battle space. But you, one of my young soldiers was a sniper in Afghanistan, Rob Kislow. I met him at Walter Reed, 2 years in Walter Reed, lost a leg below the knee, arm is titanium now. And he clearly felt revenge and payback because he had to defend himself when his buddy was killed and he was about to be attacked. It was a beehive swarming around him. They were totally overtaken in the hills of Afghanistan in the early part of the war. And as I'm listening to this tape, and an assistant is, we hear the exultation of the revenge. He's hepped up, ramped up. And after the end of the interview, you know, he then backs off and he feels nothing but shame. And he says, "Ma'am, it's a job. It's a profession. We don't enjoy it. It's a way of life." And so balancing what you need for survival and that adrenaline rush versus the indecency almost of the feeling. And I was in France, and the commandant at their Sancerre, which is West Point of France of sorts, says, "If my men and women, my boys and girls, ever fear revenge, you know, then they have something coming to them. Because once you kill the enemy, you look in their eyes, and you will never forget the face."
You write about this feeling of revenge, and I should say I'm speaking with Nancy Sherman, and she has written a book called The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. It's published by Norton. You write about one leader who didn't know he was being quoted, who talks about the rush, the hoot of killing. And you also write about the kind of formation of a soldier, how you have to go from being a civilian to being someone who can kill. Thank goodness not everyone feels the way that this soldier felt about the hoot of killing, but that in a sense we ask of our soldiers to make a journey from those of us who wouldn't consider killing anyone to someone who can pick up a gun. And as some of the soldiers say to a chaplain when they finally actually do see warfare, "Well, God still care about me if I actually do what I've just been trained
That's right.
to do."
Well, as a philosopher, and I'm not, and someone who isn't a pacifist and whose philosopher's job is to justify actions, I do think war is justified, and I do think killing in war is justified. Complicated issues about the kind of war, which war, the cause that this nation and my soldiers are always thinking about. So I do think it's a justified killing. But what I found in writing this book, and that this is probably the story of the book, that even the most just, honorable conduct in the most just war leaves stains, leaves moral residue, because soldiers really never leave behind their civilian selves. They always are multiple selves. And it's humanizing, but it's a terrible burden. So to be able to deal with it, the third sort of guilt I talk about is one that we're really seeing in Afghanistan. You're in the midst of commingled areas, civilian and insurgent, up against, mixed in imperceptibly, shifting identities, the insurgents exploiting the fact that the civilians are right there shielding the young children and innocents and women and farmers in many cases. And then our soldiers have to restrain or not restrain. And when they, even if there's an unintended but foreseen killing or an accidental killing with civilian casualties, the guilt that the soldiers feel when a child is killed is so enormous. There's vulnerability. It's the mythic child. It's a young boy warrior who could be that child, right? They're only 4 or 5 years older. And some units can't go on and fight. And they bring that home and look at their families, look at their kids, or look at their brothers and sisters and say, ooh, you know, I killed that kid. That's a hard, hard transition. And I'm afraid that really could unravel families, unravel souls.
I'm speaking with Nancy Sherman about her book, The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. It's published by Norton. We'll be back with more after a break. I'm Julie Burstein. I'm here for Leonard Lopate, and I'm with Nancy Sherman. She is a philosopher, a teacher, and she's written a book called The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers, and it's from Norton. In your book, you talk about a trip you took to Guantanamo, and you talk about interrogation. Before we get to Guantanamo, can you tell us about a young man who was an interrogator named Quinn, who you met?
Yes, Will Quinn is one of my Georgetown students, and I discovered that he was a Abu Ghraib interrogator in the cleanup act. And I,
after all the colossal
torture goings on, and I asked, I didn't know exactly when he was there, but I said, "Is there anything you did in interrogation that you don't feel so great about?" So this is in the privacy of our office. He's a wonderful, handsome man, now about 28 or so, with piercing eyes. And I realized that he probably knew a lot more about me in 3 seconds than I knew about him. At any rate, he gave 3 examples. One had to do with needling a detainee about his infidelities. A second had to do with pairing a Sunni and a Shiite in recreation time when they needed to come out of isolation, and it was as if they were still isolated
because they didn't want
to interact. Because they couldn't talk to each other. And a third one, in fact, they were arch enemies. And a third one was a case in which a female detainee fell in love with him and wanted to give him a Koran and begin talking to him about her religion, et cetera. Wanted the interpreter out of the room, so she was female, so there was no possible competition. And as he spoke, it occurred to me that what he felt awful about, and not awful in the, you know, in an ongoing nagging way, what was morally queasy, was building intimacy only in order to exploit it.
And which is what an interrogator
That's what a good interrogator does, who follows the Geneva Accords and who follows the Army manuals or any military manuals on interrogation. And when I was in Guantanamo, you know, the general at the time, General Hood, said, "This is what we aim for." And we think, oh, there's no residue that after that. There's a lot. And the way.
So that the residue isn't just from people who, like in Abu Ghraib, torture the prisoners, but even for those who follow the rules, there is a moral residue
that
follows them home.
It's just like a soldier. You do it the right way, but you still feel that you would never do this in other walks of life. He said, "I'm at Georgetown. It would be reprehensible if I exploited my friends in the way that I did there, or I walked out of a room and after this kind of session and laughed. Like, now I really got him to talk." He felt so tainted by it. And I said, "Well, what do you think about it?" This was 3 years later. I said, "I'm still thinking about these examples. What do you think?" He said, "Well, for me, it's like going into mass when it's in Latin. A war zone is going into a place that's separate from every other place. And that's how I think about it. It's a kind of compartmentalization." But in his case, he never compartmentalizes so fast and hard that he doesn't allow his conscience to be with him all the time. He never stepped over boundaries, though he knows the temptation. And unlike the guy on the field, for him, it's not survival or victory. It's power. How do I deal with the awful fact of my power?
You write right after this story about an interrogator who doesn't grapple with the same kind of questions of conscience. And from reading it, it seems that that is the more dangerous position, is to go into that power and not even question it.
That's
or begin
right.
to understand how, even when you're following the rules, it can be something that is morally. Quinn says there's a difference between legal and moral. And the other man, I think, doesn't quite understand that there might be a moral cost, even if legally he's doing the right thing.
That's right. He doesn't at all. And in fact, he looks for loopholes. We let them do the dirty work, meaning other governments do United States dirty work. And for him, he has to give his guys, the fellow interrogators, R&R, relaxation and recreation, as therapy. He's a doctor that makes them better. It's the kind of an old ancient metaphor. But there's never any moral horizon for this man. And there was such a stark contrast for me as I was going through both personalities and cases.
You went to Guantanamo because there were allegations that there were medical personnel there who were complicit in some of the things that were going on in terms of the interrogations and the treatment of prisoners, and there were a lot of hunger strikes. What did you find when you went?
Well, I found, as many do who go, that it was a cocooned visit. It was in, 2005, the fall of 2005, and we were meant to be independent observers. The head of the American Psychiatric and American Psychological were there, and we were concerned with the medical and mental health of the detainees and the hunger strikers. So what we found was that in one case, at that point, the Surgeon General of the Army Surgeon General was more interested in the size of the nasogastro tube, et cetera, than
for the feeding
mm-hmm. for the hunger strikers. Than if the he sort of said, well, do they complain? You know, and the internist in charge said, no, they really don't. But, you know, being coerced is not an example of compliance or voluntary choice. So that was one thing. Also, there was an attempt at the time, and to some degree, it's been an ongoing battle. The military has wanted to use psychologists as consultation folks, consultants in interrogation techniques. They're called BISCTS, Behavioral Science Consultation Team members.
Even Quinn talks about how a behavioralist who he consults when he can't break a particular prisoner says, have her fall in love with you.
Yes, it's the Patty Hearst kind of syndrome, right? And there are those folks, and then there's the folks on the psychiatric side who are often MDs who are doing more of the healing and the clinical work as opposed to the interrogation strategy work. And my claim throughout is that they're anyone involved in torture or an administration that promotes it is under pressure to not do their job the best they can, which involves all sorts of constraints on how you treat patients or subjects with respect. And there's been a lot of noise in the association. So what I found really was that we were being used in a little bit to draw artificial lines between this kind of professional stripe and that kind of professional stripe. And that's, again, legal loopholing, which has been the name of the game in the torture debate. And we're tired of that.
One of the things you also write about is soldiers feeling that they need to fight for a just cause. And you quote Shakespeare and Henry V going to try to rally his troops, but going undercover and finding that his soldiers just say, the king is telling me to do this, and if it's wrong, it's the king's fault, not mine. And you also write about soldiers who, for the best of reasons, join the army or one of the other services to fight for their country, and then, as one of them says, feel suckered about what they're doing now.
Yeah, that was a very, very powerful, powerful word that just resonated with me. And when I say soldiers, I mean warriors, sailors, airmen and women, Air Force men and women, and as well as Marines and soldiers, Army soldiers. So in this case, Derek Vines, older guy. They called him Pops. He was a senior enlisted. Had been in Bosnia and Iraq. Never quite felt like the right war in the early days. He hoped he was going to be called up. He was part of the reserves to go to Afghanistan. It didn't work out. And he was part of an intel group, intelligence. So he was looking, or at least had to verify in some way, not looking for WMDs, but needed to get information that was peripheral to it. And he said, did we ever find WMDs? I mean, did we ever find them? No. To be suckered like that by your upper echelon, that's a hard pill to swallow. And he's a quiet, pensive guy with a little melancholy in his eyes. And 55 African-American, works where I was at the time, a fellow in the Wilson Center downtown. Very interesting think tank. He was my tech support man. And he just, you could feel it, that he said, I would go again, there's no doubt. I'm patriotic. Doesn't matter if it's a Republican or Democrat, and you never not go because you fight for your comrades. But he wanted to fight for the cause, and he didn't believe in the cause. And you know, and so the sense of fidelity was horizontal that way, but he felt betrayed when he looked up vertically to who put him there. And solidarity is what keeps them together, keeps them alive, covering each other's back. And he wasn't going to give that up. But he's nonetheless felt betrayed from those higher up.
I'm speaking with Nancy Sherman. Her book is The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. It's published by Norton. The last part of the book really focuses on the trauma that soldiers experience, both physical and psychological and moral, which is a dimension that I think not many of us talk about all the time, is the moral trauma of doing this kind of work. You write about one soldier who thought he was fine and came home and was sitting at dinner with his wife for her birthday, and there was a loud noise, and suddenly he was transported immediately back to incoming bombs.
That's right. That's Tony DiStefano. And again, these are not young guys. He's in his mid-50s now or so and was part of the reserves and guards, and we forget that they're really also fighting this war, and they're often not coming home to units that are cohesive in the way that regular units are, although he became a regular soldier.
And which I would guess is different. You talk about Derek and that kind of horizontal loyalty, but to come back and then be suddenly thrust back into your job and your family, that's a very different
experience. That's right. When you're out there, you're in the unit cohesion is critical for sound fighting. And then in Derek's case, too, he was in the Guards. You just get dispersed, you know, in his case in Washington, D.C. suburbs, and in this other man's case in Pennsylvania. So he's home, and he thinks everything's fine and has some back injuries and some sleep apnea, but not much else, he thinks. And then he just spirals downward, beginning with this flashback incident. Often they're anniversaries. You don't, not quite sure. Even my Uncle Marvin, who may actually be listening now, is a veteran of Okinawa, World War II, and he's had these severe flashback memories 50 years after incidents on a ridge with bayonet fighting. And so in the case of Tony, he went undercover, and he starts saying, 2 seconds, 2 seconds, the bomb's going off. And it was a bomb that for many would have left them untouched. Him, it really touched hard, and he spent many, many weeks in VA institutes, 2 years in Walter Reed. And in his case, the PTSD wasn't really, a doctor didn't believe in it and said, if I get a second opinion back and it's negative, you're going to be charged with malingering, namely trying to get out of service. And that, he said, that's, Tony said, to serve your country with such sacrifice and honor and to be told that is the highest offense.
How should our country be addressing these needs of soldiers, both in terms of the moral preparation for war and then in terms of how to bring them back into civilian life? Are there things that we could be doing that we're not?
Yes. Well, in terms of going there, we need to have therapists, chaplains, and the officers themselves who are leading units be really good commanders, really good leaders who are open about the psychological issues. You know, we don't need hard-nosed guys, but we need to hear not just about the adrenaline rush, but about what might happen when there's loss and when there's real stress, and to be ready to refer their troops to psychological help.
And you write about one woman who lost an arm who said, you know, the training helped with my instincts. My instincts kicked in, and she still was able to direct her troops after being injured.
Yeah, she lost an arm. She was a basketball player and is quite an amazing woman at managing a company and all that.
But she was not trained to deal emotionally.
No. She's a self-starter, she said. She sort of had her own regimen of discipline at Walter Reed, and whatever they asked, she did it 10 times more. I mean, she's a real West Point cadet person. But she needed that in order to get her unit back, the squad back to the, to get her through this injury. She knew she had like this golden twilight period, whatever.
Mm-hmm. The golden hour.
The golden hour to get her medevaced. But there's all, what can we do? The book is a plea to listen to soldiers. I'm in a university setting. Many of us are in campuses, or we have colleagues who have returned, or neighbors, I suspect. If you go up and down a block or in an apartment building, there are several families who have people coming home. We're afraid to ask as if we're invading, or that's just stuff that has to go on in a clinician's office. No, I found that if you give soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, and women the time, they will talk to you, and you'd be surprised what goes on. They're not all dysfunctional. They're not all self-medicating. They're not all with road rage. They're rather trying to sort out what it's like to lose a buddy and be the survivor, what it's like to deal without an arm. You know, why do you go to the classroom and you get there 15 minutes early before everyone so no one really sees you, Dawn says. Why'd you stop wearing your prosthetic? Because it's too heavy. And the one that's just pretty doesn't do me any good. So talk to them. You know, stop putting this icy barrier between us and them. We have a civilian military gap that's still yawning. And private respect we owe them, and not just public lip service respect.
Are there lessons from the ancients that you look at in terms of the way that soldiers were treated when they returned, whether the war was just or not, but the way that a soldier was seen?
I think so. Well, they certainly grieved on sight in Homer's time, and they cried like a baby.
Well, that I found fascinating. That you know, you look at the Iliad and at both at Achilles' atrocious treatment of Hector's body, where he drags it through the muck and really defiles it, and then to how he meets with Hector's father and they can both weep.
Priam and he weep. And Achilles really is early survivor guilt. You know, it should have been me. He lets Patroclus wear his armor.
His best friend.
But I would say just two things. One is there are lessons from the old, but there are also lessons that I want to avoid. My dad just died in December.
I'm sorry.
I was cleaning up his effects. He was a World War II medic. And I found his dog tags. He had carried them for 65 years in his pocket. I'm a very close daughter.
He carried them with him every day?
Yes.
Wow.
And that, I think, was an unconscious part of the motive for writing this book. They were his private burden. He had to morally sort out the horror, and as he always would say, the hell of war, and holding on to his army identity and the burden of it and the ugliness of it was his way of paying respect back and also figuring it out. Never going to let it go.
Did he share it with you too?
Only toward the end, when I started being a scholar in this area and writing, being a writer about this. But so I don't think that private burden is the way to go. It's a public burden. Soldiers are our surrogates. They may not be the wars we want to fight, but they're there. They're fighting, and they are amongst us. And they always are still civilians. They're citizen soldiers who return to us. So it's a public shared moral burden.
Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Nancy Sherman about her book, The Untold War, Inside the Hearts, Minds, and Souls of Our Soldiers. It's published by Norton. Thank you so much for joining us today.
That's great. And I would say there's a program tonight that you'll probably talk about.
Yes, we'll hear about it in a moment. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.